This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to the show and happy Wednesday. But more importantly, happy Dog Day. It's like Dog International Pet Day, Dog Day. I don't even know.
Why talk about it if you're not going to get my daughter's birthday correct?
I was about to.
How dare you? It's National Dog Day for folks that don't know. And clearly, Shira doesn't, you know, she doesn't dwell with us dog lovers, our pet owners, pet parents. She doesn't live in that world. So, of course, she disrespects our birthdays.
Because my dog was taken from me by my ex-boyfriend. You know that's a trigger, Ryan. Thanks.
Shira, that's not your dog. It was always your ex-boyfriend's dog. Just because y'all were together, that does not mean I really need people to settle this for us. I'm just saying. I just want people to settle that. Because guess what? Shira, her ex got a dog, and they had the dog together in the relationship. Once they broke up, that dog officially became her exes, but she thinks it's still her dog. I don't get it.
Sorry that I've known that dog since it was a baby, and he will forever be my dog. Bentley, I'm thinking about you on Dog Day. Just saying.
Then
I've got a son too.
I hope your ex asks for doggy child support because you are owed in back support for sure.
Okay, there's always a way to make this show like therapy for us, isn't there? But let's get into what you can expect from the show today, besides some of that madness. In the midst of COVID, you know, a lot of people are looking to refinance their homes. But if you're a Black person or a person of color, that may not go your way. And we discuss why and what you can do about that later in the show.
I am so excited for this story. I saw it last night. We saw it on the New York Times. It's going viral. I mean, it's crazy. This is important, and I'm excited to have it.
Yeah, but let's get into some what's trending this hour. California Representative Kevin McCarthy teased his RNC speech for tonight on Fox News, promising something weird.
We renew the American dream. And how will we restore our way of life, securing our cities, making them safe again? I think that contrast alone will show why President Trump will earn 4 more years. And tomorrow is much, much better than what today will be.
Okay, it's here. More things at the RNC. I don't know.
Seriously, if you don't have a bottle of wine or a bottle of champagne or a bottle of your hardest liquor, I don't see how you can really get through watching the RNC. It was night two and I had felt like I already had a pack of cigarettes and a half a bottle of wine. Seriously.
Well, the third night of the RNC starts again tonight, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. And we are discussing what might have been illegal that happened last night right after this. Now, horrible news come out of Kenosha, Wisconsin. Kyle Rittenhouse, who's 17, is suspected of fatally shooting at least 2 people and injuring another during protests in Kenosha over the shooting of Jacob Blake. And he has now been charged with murder. Rittenhouse was arrested in Illinois and faces charges of first-degree intentional homicide, according to Lake County, Illinois Clerk of Courts Public Records. He is labeled a fugitive from justice in the complaint. It says that the teenager fled the state of Wisconsin with intent to avoid prosecution for that offense. And he's been assigned a public defender and was scheduled to appear at an extradition hearing on August 28th, according to those court records. And it's just crazy.
Let's make sure people heard that. Yes, he is 17 and he had an assault rifle just walking around the street, passing these tanks, these police officers. There's a video actually of him around a group of people and they all have weapons, and the military are these officers. They actually give them a bottle of water saying, "I appreciate you. We appreciate you so much right now." That is the state of this country. I have lost all hope, and this is ridiculous. 17, and he's going out murdering folks. I can't.
Tragic. Now, in sports news, and this is connected to everything happening, Milwaukee Bucks are boycotting game 5 of their NBA playoff series in response to the Blake shooting. Bucks players didn't leave their locker room for their game 5 against the Orlando Magic in response to the police shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And the NBA has announced that all of Wednesday's playoff games would be postponed as a result of Milwaukee's decision.
You know, this is huge. I mean, we are starting to see, especially, I wonder, obviously, Roger Goodell has also been kind of speaking out about racial injustice and apologizing to George, what's his name? Colin Kaepernick.
Kaepernick, yeah. Colin Kaepernick.
So I'm interested in seeing kind of what happens the remainder of this season of just sports in general. And then obviously the NBA is making a good decision to support their players' decision, because I think last year, a year ago from now, we would not have seen that.
Social justice and the sports world were not as intertwined. And if anything, it was frowned upon from, players would get kicked out or get a penalty or somehow have to pay something. So things have changed and times are changing. Now let's move into top stories in pop culture and entertainment news. That was What's Trending This Hour.
Here's the T Report. This is what we call those pop culture moments that are trending right now. Yeah. Crazy story coming out, and it is a major pivot from the story we were just talking about. But Bella Thorne, Shira. Bella Thorne is burning it up over on OnlyFans. So within 24 hours of debuting her page on the site, the actress set a record by earning more than $1 million. She announced this launch a couple of days ago, or like on August 14th. It was like last week. She's been using the platform to share personal content and never before seen photos and videos for subscription rates. So I don't even think she's doing anything like on the sex side of things. She's just showing behind the scenes content, and everyone was like, "Oh, Bella Thorne?" And that is your T Report, honey, those pop culture moments that are trending right now.
Now, again, we are doing Feed Our Family still here at radio.com so that you can help children and their families all over Southern California who are going to bed hungry. And we have an easy way for you to help right now. Just text the word need to 76278, need to 76278 to give even just a dollar, put food in the mouth of a hungry kid and their loved ones. For more, go to wearechannelq.com. Now, coming up, night 2 of the RNC didn't disappoint with the WTF moments. We're playing and discussing those viral clips next in 10 minutes.
With that in mind, I like to call on the citizens of this country to take a moment, pause, and look at things from all perspectives. I urge people to come together in a civil manner so we can work and live up to our standard American ideals. I also ask people to stop the violence and looting being done in the name of justice, and never make assumptions based on the color of a person's skin.
That was First Lady Melania Trump speaking at the second night of the RNC. I got DNC on my mind. But we have to remember it's the RNC. A lot of people saying that was the most empathy that's been shown from the White House around COVID-19. And here for a recap of all the highlights and what we can expect from night 3 of the RNC is Fox News contributor Richard Fowler. Thanks for being here again.
It's good to be with you, Sharon Ryan. How are y'all?
Great. So, a lot of things going down here. I don't even know where to start.
Oh, God.
I mean, what I guess stood out for you, and we have a few clips that we want to play here today as well.
Well, let me say this. I think it was a very interesting night. I think it was definitely a calmer night from night 1 of the RNC, which is a little, let's say, off the wall. I think it was calmer. I mean, my biggest takeaway from last night was I think the Republicans are trying to paint this sort of panacea of where we are as a country. Mm-hmm. I think you heard that from Larry Kudlow's remarks, where he sort of talked about the United States being in an economic boom, even though there are currently 30 million unemployed Americans, and According to Oxford, the Oxford Industry Review, there's going to be 4 million small businesses that will close their doors by the end of this year. And we are in an economic, at the end of next month, the economists will likely come back and tell us that we are currently in a recession. So yeah. I think they're trying to make this sort of rosy picture of where the country currently is, when the truth of the matter is that our country is in chaos.
Again, we're talking to Fox News contributor Richard Fowler about the RNC nights to last night, of course, going into the third night tonight.
I would love to talk about how race really played into night two of the RNC. We saw Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron speaking. Here's a clip of him. And honestly, I was shocked when he said Breonna Taylor's name. But here's a clip of his speech from last night.
Police and innocent bystanders. We Republicans do recognize those who work in good faith towards peace, justice, and equality. In fact, it was General Dwight Eisenhower, a future Republican president, who said, democracy is a system that recognizes the equality of humans before the law. Whether you are the family of Breonna Taylor or David Dorn, these are the ideals that will heal our nation's wounds.
So, yeah, we saw a couple of things. One, him giving a speech looking like Casper the Ghost, whoever did his makeup was awful. We moved on to see a pardon happen with President Trump announcing a pardon of John Ponder. He was a convicted bank robber turned activist. He appeared with his FBI best friend agent who actually arrested him, Richard Beasley. Let's talk about the strategy of that. How did we see race play into night two of the RNC?
Listen, it's very clear that Donald Trump is going to, you know, that he's going to try to divide, you know, black voters, right? And I think for Donald Trump, he understands that for black African-Americans, this election, there's three choices. They could either vote for Donald Trump, they could vote for Joe Biden, or they can sit at home. And Donald Trump is hoping that they either vote for him or they sit at home. And for Joe Biden, there's only one choice, that African-Americans go out and they vote for him. I think that's why you're seeing the president play, do what he's doing here, and the RNC do what they're doing. I think it was very interesting to see the Attorney General of Kentucky give a speech and mention Breonna Taylor's name, understanding that he's the person standing in the way of justice for Breonna Taylor.
Right.
He's the person that needs to open an investigation and arrest the officers who killed her. But I digress.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing about criminal justice reform and the strategy around doing all this around that, but yet it's hypocritical because they're not actually doing anything.
That part.
But how many times was the Hatch Act violated? Because I thought the one thing was, I think a pardon is good, a naturalization ceremony is wonderful, but guess what? Those moments weren't to showcase Americans, you know, being one, being free, and then two, you know, these new Americans kind of joining this country. It was all to really be a pawn for Donald Trump's strategy. I thought that was kind of disgusting. Let's talk about that. Was that an illegal moment that we saw?
Yes, indeed. That is a violation of the Hatch Act. What was more irresponsible was the fact that we saw the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, give an address from an international hotspot praising the president. Now, there's a couple of reasons why that's problematic. Number one, the Secretary of State is not allowed to engage in American politics because, this, as the saying goes, U.S. politics stops at sort of the seas, at the shore's edge, right? So it stops when you go abroad, there is no American politics. It's just one United States of America. And so for him to sit in Jerusalem and give a speech is not only against the law and against many rules at the State Department and against the Hatch Act, but it's also uncustomary. We haven't seen a Secretary of State give an address from a foreign hotspot ever in American history. And we've never seen a Secretary of State address a national convention since, I want to say, World War I or World War II. And it is a violation of the law. And when the White House Chief of Staff was asked about this earlier today on another network, he basically said, oh, it might be illegal, but nobody cares.
Okay, well, there you go. That was a recap of night two of the RNC. Thank you so much, Richard Fowler, for joining us again.
Appreciate it. Good to be with you guys.
Sure. More unexpected twists and turns night three tonight. Now coming up, could a breakthrough treatment approved by the FDA help battle COVID-19? We tell you next in 10 minutes. On Sunday, the FDA granted an emergency use authorization for doctors to administer convalescent plasma to COVID-19 patients. And here's President Trump making the announcement.
Truly historic announcement in our battle against the China virus that will save countless lives. The FDA has issued an emergency use authorization, and that's such a powerful term, emergency use authorization for a treatment known as convalescent plasma.
Dr. Amish Dalja is joining us to break that down, what it does. Thanks for being here again.
Thanks for having me.
So what is it convalescent plasma, and why is it being used to treat COVID-19 patients?
So convalescent plasma is a component of your blood that they're harvesting from individuals who have recovered from COVID, because that part of your blood contains antibodies. And what they do is take a person's plasma that's recovered and then transfuse that into another person who is ill with COVID-19 in the hope that it modifies the illness, makes them get better quicker, prevents complication. And that's something that was tried in China, and it's something we've been doing throughout this pandemic. And we're still waiting to see exactly if it works and on who it works and when it works. And those questions still remain to be answered, but it is something that we've seen some promise with so far.
Which is great news, but I guess with any new treatment, there's always safety concerns. Are there any with this?
There doesn't seem to be a major safety signal. Obviously, it is a blood product transfusion, so you have to type someone's blood, and there's always a reaction. There's always a chance of a transfusion reaction occurring. But in general, it seems relatively safe. But the key question is more about who does it work on? What time period do you give it to an individual? And is it actually working? Because a lot of these people are being given this drug outside of randomized controlled trials, and they're also getting steroids. They're also getting remdesivir. So it's hard to tease apart the effect of the convalescent plasma from the other treatments that are going on.
So at this point, if you get COVID-19, could you just go to your doctor to get this? Is it just available, easy access?
So this is something that we give to people who are admitted to the hospital with COVID-19. It's not an outpatient procedure or anything like that. So you have to be sick enough to be in the hospital to get it. And prior to the emergency use authorization, the FDA had a program called Expanded Access, where most doctors could get it through the Mayo Clinic, through a process where you consent the patient, you ask them their permission, and then you go ahead and can get it. And there've been a lot of patients, I think tens of thousands have gotten it that way. And then there were also randomized controlled trials going on. So it has been available. The emergency use authorization is not going to increase the availability of this, because it already was readily available, and I had given it to multiple patients on my own as well prior to this this authorization.
So then what's the point of an emergency use authorization? And just before you answer that, again, a reminder, we're talking to Dr. Amish Dalja from Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security about this convalescent plasma that's been announced and how it could help COVID-19 patients. So what's the difference between what was allowed before and an emergency use authorization?
It makes the paperwork a little bit easier. It's not really going to substantially change the availability of this, mm-hmm. but what it is going to do is it sort of, you know, it's being portrayed as a breakthrough treatment. And it clearly, even if it is beneficial, it's likely marginal. It's not going to be a breakthrough treatment. And one of the things that we're worried about is that the emergency use authorization, now that this is available, many people are going to say, well, the president said this is a breakthrough, fantastic type of drug. Why should we consent to be in a trial where we might get the placebo when the president says this is a great drug? The FDA has authorized its use.
Right.
All of that has bad implications. And just a week prior to this announcement, the FDA had said that they weren't going to issue an emergency use authorization because there wasn't enough data to say that it definitively was good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that's the thing, right? Because I obviously Trump's criticism of the FDA doing that, health experts are, you know, really upset by that, because it's weakening the public confidence into the FDA. How dangerous, if he keeps doing that, how much can that really play into the process of this actually happening? Could they rush it and being like, just forget it, we'll just let it happen? And then obviously that can hurt a lot of people if it's not tested well and properly.
Thankfully, with convalescent plasma, this is something that's fairly safe, but we've seen the damage that the president has done with hydroxychloroquine, creating a pent-up demand and making it very difficult for people to actually study the drug. And we know that we're going to get a vaccine some months in the future, and that vaccine is likely going to require an emergency use authorization. And we want to make sure that the population knows that what they're taking is safe and effective. And if they think that the emergency use authorization is a political tool being used to speed something, they're going to undermine, it's going to undermine confidence. We want people to be confident when we have a vaccine that's safe and effective, that this is something that they should take, because that's going to be important for us ending this pandemic. So if people have thought that this whole thing has become politicized and not something that they can actually, that there's actual scientific evidence behind what's being recommended, I mean, that undermines the entire process. So that's what I'm, you know, more worried about, is the implication that these decisions can be made on a solely political grounds, and that expertise is being ignored. All of that is really the negative consequences of this type of decision and political meddling into a scientific matter.
Wow, fascinating. Well, thank you so much again for being here with us for this.
Thanks for having me.
Again, that was Dr. Amish Adalja, who is a senior scholar, Dr. Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Wow. Now coming up, one of the speakers for this week's RNC is under fire for saying police would be smart to profile her own son. We discuss why next in 10 minutes. Anti-abortion activist Abby Johnson, who's been one of the Republican National Convention's top speakers, said in a recent video making the rounds on social media that it would be smart for a police officer to racially profile her biracial son.
So statistically, when a police officer sees a brown man like my Jude walking down the road, as opposed to my white nerdy kids, my white nerdy men, walking down the road, because of the statistics that he knows in his head, that these police officers know in their head, they're going to know that statistically, my brown son is more likely to commit a violent offense over my white sons. That doesn't actually make me angry. That makes that police officer smart.
Now, that 15-plus minute video was posted to YouTube in late June after weeks of nationwide protests against the police killing of George Floyd. But I mean, problematic much?
It doesn't matter when that was posted. The fact that she is saying that, and she's talking about racial discrimination about her own son, and that she's okay with that, is quite alarming. And honestly, if I was like the Child Protective Services, I would do a welfare check to see how well that son, that child is doing, because this is dangerous, right? When we're seeing that this is another representation of the Republican Party, she's also very anti-abortion. Last night, she gave a speech at the RNC where she immediately tweeted afterwards that unborn children won last night. It's so dangerous. One, when you think about it, these white families who are adopting biracial kids or black children or children of color, they are the most dangerous people to these kids of color, if you really think about it. Because guess what? They're taking their own biases and they're now putting it on their child and saying, well, my nerdy white kid, it's just the differences that you hear her speak about her child is disgusting to me. It's honestly revolting.
It's scary. Yeah. So to be clear, she said she would be angry if a police officer treated her brown son violently, more violently than the white son. But this, if he's on more high alert with my brown son than he is with my white son, that doesn't make me angry, because that's just smart because of statistics. Okay. And this is where it continues to get problematic, because she blames it all on dads not being in the picture. Is ridiculous.
Well, it's such a shame, right? You know, the RNC canceled Speaker Mary Ann Mendoza after she promoted this QAnon anti-Semitic conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And this lady really, she put out a link and literally tweeted, said, do yourself a favor and read this. And going forth, it was all this anti-Semitic stuff. And they canceled her. They said, hey, you're not going to be allowed to speak. Why have they not done the same thing to Abby Johnson? This is completely ridiculous, especially, like you said, on the heels of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Jacob Blake specifically. This is just something that I find to be so dangerous, and it's just really sad. I really hope that there is a lot of backlash, because she really needs to learn a lot before she does more harm to her child, to be honest. That thinking is going to do so much traumatic harm to her child.
Well, they won't do anything, because she feeds into things that they want to push to their base, which is pro-life, and then also promoting the fact that racism doesn't exist in America and that they get it.
I mean, can I read this quote?
Go for it. We're here.
She said, but one day he's going to grow up and he's going to be tall. And she's talking about her biracial son. She said, probably sort of large, intimidating looking, maybe brown man. And my other boys are probably going to look like a nerdy, like nerdy white guys.
Can we have like, what does the son think of all this? I can't imagine the trauma. All right. Now coming up, another Fort Hood soldier is missing. What is going on over there? We have all the details next in What's Trending This Hour. We're back with more show for you, including a change.org petition that's going viral to get a teacher back in school because she was kicked out for being inclusive, basically. That's coming up later this hour. But let's get into some What's Trending This Hour, though, shall we? GOP congressional candidate Kim Klasick, who is running for Congress in a blue district in Maryland, addressed the RNC, giving her take on the Democratic Party.
You'd think Maryland taxpayers would be getting a whole lot since our taxes are out of control. Instead, we're paying for decades of incompetence and corruption. Sadly, the same cycle of decay exists in many of America's Democrat-run cities. And yet the Democrats still assume that black people will vote for them, no matter how much they let us down and take us for granted. We're sick of it. We're not going to take it anymore. The days of blindly supporting the Democrats are coming to an end.
And of course, stay tuned again for the RNC happening in actually in 30 minutes. And we're bringing you constant coverage right here on Let's Go There. Now, the Major League Baseball game was postponed not long after the NBA's Milwaukee Bucks boycotted a playoff game against the Orlando Magic. Milwaukee Brewers were supposed to play against the Cincinnati Reds today. The decision is a protest against the police shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And so it's amazing to see the sports world rally around this right now.
Oh, this is baseball again. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
okay,
so it was NBA before, and now it's the MLB.
Yo, I'm really shocked here. We are really seeing kind of a domino effect happen, an actual, which I am so appreciative of. I will say the best thing about this awakening is that now people cannot go back to the norm because there's an accountability that people will always have, black and brown folks will always have, and no one's taking the crap anymore. No one's taking kind of the baiting of it all. So I appreciate this.
And their white counterparts will support them, hopefully, or else, well, they'll be called out. That's
For sure. I don't, and if they're going to fake like they support before they don't publicly support, you know?
Yeah. Now, this is so crazy and strange, and I'm sure there's going to be some investigations around this and the connection to another death that recently happened at Fort Hood. A body believed to be that of a missing Fort Hood soldier has been found. This is the latest one. Officials are awaiting forensic confirmation, but police said that they identified the body and it indicated that it is that of Sergeant Elder Fernandez. And they said that at this initial stage of the investigation, there's no indication of foul play. And that comes from Temple, Texas police. Officers were dispatched around 6 p.m. last night for a medical call at some railroad tracks. And what's crazy about this, though, is that the attorney says there should be a congressional investigation into the death. Why? Because he was found hanging from a tree. He'd previously been reported being the victim of abusive sexual contact. Now, why this is so strange is because this comes after Vanessa Guillen was also found dead after reporting sexual abuse.
Which that story
coming out of Fort Hood. How people are not seeing this connection is crazy, and that they don't think foul play was involved in all this.
I mean, that Vanessa story.
Very questionable.
I mean, it's such a hard story to listen to and to read about. And so, wow, this is crazy. I'm shocked that there's nothing really happening here, but wow.
Yeah, more to come, I'm sure. Definitely raises a lot of questions right now. Now, that was some What's Trending This Hour, but let's move into some stories and entertainment news. What's going on, Ryan?
Yes, I got a hilarious story in the T Report. You know, those pop culture stories that are trending right now. Now, speaking of the RNC, Cardi B is popping back up into Republicans' mouths. It's hilarious. So following the First Lady speech last night, at the Republican National Convention, Cardi B had to clap back at a Republican firebrand. Her name is Deanna Lorraine. She tweeted this. She said, America needs far more women like Melania Trump and far less like Cardi B. Well, Cardi B, of course, did what she did and had the funniest clapback of it all and said, didn't she used to sell that WAP? referring to her controversial new single. And of course, she was also referring to the first lady who has been known to formerly work as a model and pose for several full frontal nudes. She has a lot of those photos. And also, she was engaged as an escort at one point. No evidence has surfaced to support these rumors, but those, honey, is what the streets is saying.
Okay.
And so I just love Cardi B. It was like the best moment to come out of last night, and alleviate, you know, actually have some humor surrounding it. And that's your tea report of the pop culture moments that is trending right now.
And of course, we want to remind you about Feed Our Families. It's still happening here at radio.com because children and their families all over Southern California are going to bed hungry. Mm-hmm. And we can really use your help to feed local students and their families right now, including during the back to school season.
Yeah. So text the word need to 76278 to give a buck, just $1, and put food in the mouth of a hungry kid and their loved ones.
Again, that's need to 76278. And for more info on all this, just go to wearechannelq.com. Now, coming up, the housing market is being exposed. We tell you how Black homeowners are facing discrimination in appraisals. That's next in 10 minutes. Race and housing policy have been part of this country for a long time, and Black Americans consistently struggle more than their white counterparts to be approved for home loans. Plus, there's redlining, a practice that denied mortgages to people of color in certain neighborhoods, and it continues to drive down home values in Black neighborhoods. And here to explain more on what's being done to hopefully change this once and for all is Andre Perry, a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So there is policy, there are acts to protect against discrimination in the housing and real estate industry. So how is this still happening so blatantly?
Because we may have changed the laws, but we have not changed the practices that were, a lot of which were formed during a period when it was legal to segregate against African Americans. Remember that the federally backed Homeowners Loan Corporation in the 1930s redlined Black neighborhoods, and they essentially established this template of deeming Black people too risky to lend out loans. Fast forward to 2020, we still see the residuals of those practices in the form of lower home values on Black homes. What recent New York Times article that I was featured in showed that homes in Black neighborhoods are undervalued by 23%, on average about $48,000 per home. Accumulatively, there's about $156 billion in lost equity, largely because of the perception of the neighborhood. We controlled for education, we controlled for crime, we controlled for walkability and all those fancy Zillow metrics. So you had an apples to apples comparison, with the only explanation was the concentration of Black people around the home that lowered the price.
And what's so telling is, like, this is happening to obviously average Black Americans and people of color across this country, but it's also happening to celebrities. I mean, comedian D.L. Hughley, he wrote in his book talking about an experience that he had on his own home that he was selling. I think it's so interesting how home appraisers, and a lot of them are saying, you know, it's their job to report on local market conditions, not to set them. What do you say to something like that?
Well, one, that's not necessarily true. Appraisers of all the housing professionals do establish price, and they do so by looking at comparables in the area. Oftentimes, though, they use the wrong comparables. In the chapter of my book, I look at one particular property owner who instead of looking at equally yoked commercial properties, they used abandoned gas stations, they used all kinds of stuff. So there's a lot of discretion in how appraisers actually price the Black properties. But a lot of my research, it shows that when people look at Black communities, it almost is as if they see twice as much crime or twice or worse education than there actually is, which reduces the value. And so a lot of that is just based on perception.
Yeah. Again, we're talking to Andre Perry, who's the author of the new book, Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. It seems like that's very racist, basically. The appraisers are racist.
Yes. For sure.
And then it also seems like when this happens in white neighborhoods where there are
black individuals living there, that it's happening too. So what is going on? Because in this article, it talked about this couple where there was, a mixed race couple, and they saw all these pictures, and when they then put it, the white guy selling it with all the white pictures and the white stuff, then they got a higher number.
Yeah, isn't it a shame that you have to try to scrub black people from a home in order to get your fair value?
Oh,
that,
my
goodness.
That's
what folks are trying to do. And that's what that report actually showed, that there are black homeowners. If you have a white partner who goes out and fills out the application, you're getting positive feedback. As soon as folks start to see blackness in any kind of form, they start reducing the value of the home. And many people, including D.L. Hughley and other celebrities, note that their property should be of higher value. But so, again, this is subjective in nature.
What's being done? Are they getting a ping on their license? Like, couldn't they be sued for that?
They could go to jail.
And there's fraud, but there's little recourse. A homeowner or someone else can actually appeal, but those appeals generally fall on deaf ears. And in some markets, the property is sold because folks typically sell the property because they have to. And so folks don't want to wait around for the judicial time it takes in order to find a remedy. And so it really puts black and brown people at a loss financially at a significant number.
Well, I think black and brown people are sold this myth that if you get into the housing market, you buy your house, it kind of can create this generational wealth. When discussing generational wealth, especially for black folks, there's a huge puzzle piece missing. How should we have realistic conversations about this and making sure that we're telling the full picture?
You know, there is a white supremacist myth that says the conditions of black cities are a direct result of the people in them, the residents in them. And we know that there's been policies and practices that have devalued black lives and property. We need to have a serious conversation about those practices and policies, because people are doing everything that they are told to get the American dream, but they're just not benefiting from those actions. In fact, we're preyed upon in terms of predatory lending. When we do get a home, we get them at higher interest rates. And when we do have property, they're not valued at the same level. So we do need to have a policy adjustment on these issues.
And more accountability, it seems. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now coming up, find out how colleges shutting back down is actually harming lower income students. That's next in 10 minutes. Colleges are being forced to close after COVID-19 outbreaks on their campuses. So while the move is protecting many, it's also harming their lower income students. And here to share more about what's happening is Dr. John Paul Higgins. Welcome back to the show. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation with y'all.
Yeah, it's definitely an important one. It's happening in real time. So how does this actually harm lower income students? Because I think that a lot of times we're just looking at overall the student population and the health right now, but it's much deeper than that.
Yeah, it is. And so I think what a lot of folks don't know, so I always kind of like to think about how I would place myself in this situation if this was happening to me when I was a college student. So, you know, specifically being gay, being queer, and being from a low socioeconomic status, when I went to college, I initially went to college with this notion of I can't go back home if I don't have an option. Where I was prior to that, you know, we were in a very small location. When I went to college, it was very much like, you know, my family was very supportive, but it was also one of those situations of like, if you come home, you can't stay here, sis, you know? So I think that that's the thing that a lot of folks are not taking into consideration, that when there are 5, 6, 7, 8 people in a home, and, you know, you have one student go off to college, and then they come, you know, a situation like this where they're like, oh, I have to return home. What are you returning to? I mean, I remember working in higher ed and having students say that they remember going home and their second rooms becoming rooms for their uncles and aunts, right? Mm. So this notion that, you know, they're like, the room that I grew up in is no longer my room. I sleep on the couch, or I have to sleep on the floor. These are the things that our students are dealing with. And then you want to take into consideration, and you want to talk about too, what a lot of folks don't also recognize and understand is that the money that these students might even be getting for financial aid that's supposed to be helping them while they're living on campus is now being cut. So go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, how is it that tuition's staying the same and yet aid's being cut?
Aid is
that's
being
lame.
Cut.
That doesn't make sense. I mean, it makes sense, I guess, if you're the college because you're trying to save money, but like, it's not fair.
Right. And it's not fair. And so now you have students that are saying that, you know, okay, I'm just going to throw out a really interesting, you know, number. You have a school that is $32,000 a year, and that $32,000 is supposed to include your room and board, because 20 of that is your room and board. That's right. $20,000 that's now gone.
Yeah.
And you're still having to pay for books. You're still having to pay for all of this because everyone's moving online. But let's not even talk about the online conversation as to, okay, now I'm going back to a home where I no longer have a room or space, but now my family doesn't have money for food for me. And then on top of that, we don't have money for internet. Because we can barely pay our bills.
But here's the thing, and what we're seeing, right? And I was reading this story on Vox.com, this amazing article that was talking about kind of this. A lot of it felt like the responsibility was on the school. There was a lack of preparation on the school, and it was affecting and kind of creating this domino effect. Is that what we're seeing across the country?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, it's very interesting. Like I said, I have an article that's going to be coming out in a couple of weeks, and it's talking about the domino effect of what's happening in higher education, not even just higher education, but in education as a whole. The American education system has never been prepared for this. There have been numerous research studies that have been done around the ways that education is ineffective when we start talking about distance learning. And so even within that conversation around distance learning and the statistics and the number, when we start talking about Black and Brown students, specifically Black and Brown students in low socioeconomic status locations or places of where they live, now you have a system that's not made to fare for them, but you're also dealing with this idea of a larger issue of now, you know, the larger system has no idea of what they're going to do in order to better serve them. So it really is a cyclical issue. It's a very circular motion of you have a larger system that doesn't know what to do. The systems that are on the ground teaching these students don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And now the students who are in the system don't know what to do. And you just have it constantly circling and moving around.
Yeah. Dr. John Paul Higgins joins us right now as we discuss college reopenings and closures and how it's harming low-income students. So with all this knowledge and all of this being discovered and coming out, even though it was pretty obvious that it was going to happen, what are colleges doing or what's being done to protect these students?
Well, you know, so from what I've seen, I have friends who still work on college campuses. You know, some of them are reopening, you know, as we saw at like Syracuse, they totally reopened, had COVID cases, and now they're talking about closing again. You have some institutions that are ultimately saying part of our system will open up, part of our system won't. And then you have institutions that are saying we're doing full digital. Everything will be done online. No one will come back to campus and we'll push forward that way. And I think ultimately right now, what it really comes down to is you just have a lot of institutions and a lot of people scrambling.
And sending, we see you and we hear you messages like to the entire campus, but like not providing any actions or tangible like solutions.
Correct. So you have a whole bunch of individuals who are ultimately saying, you know, we know that this is a very trying time. You know, thank you. Thank you for choosing this institution. Have a good day. You know, it's like none of them are really saying this is the way that we plan. But when you really think about it, if you really want to go there, you know, and I know that.
How about you? Mm-hmm. You better do that.
If you really want to go there, a lot of these institutions have been operating on a fly by night scenario forever. Right. A lot of institutions have no idea what they're doing or what, you know, they're ultimately really just putting a lot of Band-Aids over a lot of broken bricks.
You know, Dr. John, one thing I really want to touch on before we wrap this up is I think we're going to start seeing a huge surge of students who are just going to drop out because of the added pressure. Are we already starting to see that?
Yep, the achievement gap is going to implode within the next year. That is literally the way I see it. And I say this because the numbers have already been dropping for marginalized students specifically in the last few years, right? Retention rates have already been really terrible when you start looking at the data. It only makes sense to me that now you start thinking about what is happening on the outside. I can't find a job. My financial aid is being cut. All of these different things is telling the students who are struggling or are low income students that, you know, college is not for them or college is not there to help them. So what's going to be the other option, right?
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us for this conversation. We appreciate it. That was Dr. John Paul Higgins. And coming up, a Texas teacher has been put on leave for supporting LGBTQ+ rights and Black Lives Matter. We discuss what actually happened next in 10 minutes. A teacher in Texas has reportedly been placed on administrative leave after she allowed students to submit their pronouns. That's a good thing, right? And she posted LGBTQ+ rights and Black Lives Matter images on her virtual classroom.
Now, the image from this teacher, Taylor Lifka, and her remote learning site, it went viral. It was posted online Friday by Marian Knowlton, who's a Republican candidate for Texas's 31st district, who took offense at these efforts to include trans students, women, students of color, and queer kids in the classroom.
This is so embarrassing and so sad for this woman. I don't understand the fear that conservatives, Republicans, whoever has about their children learning about LGBTQ history and Black Lives Matter, like learning about what that all means and teaching, you know, actually what we're supposed to be learning, right? Because I think there's been this whitewashing of history and people have been okay with that. These, you know, Republican, conservative, or traditional parents are okay with that. But guess what? It's a new wave of generation of teachers who are younger, who are millennials, who are Gen Zers, who are coming in saying, we want to change things. We want to shift how education is taking place. And I think that's a positive thing, I would think.
Oh, yeah. I think this idea that this side of things is propaganda without thinking that what if what we've always been learning in these societal norms are propaganda as well? Who says that's normal? As it's better to be pushing that and that creates more choices than actually showcasing all the choices and possibly what, you know, a student or an individual could feel at even a young age if they're presented something otherwise. Like, we all know that creates more suicide. We all know that creates more mental health issues. We all know that, you know, someone who becomes queer has been shown a lot of heterosexual stuff, and it's not like they became heterosexual.
Great. Pronouns is English. They're going to learn pronouns anyway. So it's just like, who cares? Sweet. That's really what they're going to learn. So you're telling me they don't want her to teach no type of English at this point? It's just, I know you were talking about, you've had experiences with your own friends who are parents. So,
yeah. Last year I had a conversation with a good friend of mine that I grew up with. And she said, you know, her three sons are going to school right now and they're starting to learn this stuff at a very early age. And she said, I think it's just too young for them to learn this. They don't get it. And then it's like, well, but I think that these young people are smarter than we think. And it's like, what do they need to get? The fact that people get to choose whatever they want to choose and we get to accept them. Like, why is that so hard? And why are we so scared about that?
Yeah, it's a bias, right? It's parents going in with their own set of biases. And then now they're projecting that on their kids and they want to kind of shield and protect. Like, I was a very, and my mom admits this, like my mom admits that I was a very shielded child growing up. And I think she thought that was what was best. But it oftentimes, it actually was quite harmful because I had to go find outside resources, friends even, to educate me on my own sexuality, my own person. And that's unfortunate when it shouldn't have to be that way because the world is literally wrapped around heterosexuality. And you would think if I'm being taught all this, it's the same thing. They're worried that, oh, if they're taught gay stuff or queer stuff or, you know, all these things that they're going to turn into this. That's far from the truth.
Yeah. And for me, it's a lack of compassion saying, well, this stuff is complicated for me because I'm not that. But then not thinking about the other people who are experiencing that and thinking that, well, what about these normatives, these social norms? How is that? That's complicated for them. We're creating complications either way. So might as well create a safe space that everyone can be seen, accepted, and choose into what they want to be and how they want to be. All right. Well, there's actually a change.org petition that's been signed by more than 15,000 people. It's calling for the LGBT inclusive Texas teacher to be reinstated. And hopefully with all of this response,
I'm about to sign it. I'm literally about to sign it right now.
Now coming up, the iconic Sturgis motorcycle rally in South Dakota might be a super spreader of COVID-19. We have the numbers coming out from there next in What's Trending This Hour. We're continuing the show and coming up, the impact of following your ex on social media. We got our favorite psychologist, Dr. Josh Klapo, joining us for that because all of us, whether you're married, you're in a relationship, you follow people from your past on social media. But there's ways to do it that are healthy and there's ways to do it that are unhealthy.
I'm sorry. I just don't believe that there's really any unhealthy ways. Just cut the people off and call it a day. Now, Shira, I know that's hard for you. But I know that segment, that conversation coming up will be able to help everyone.
Oh, thank you for soothing all my anxieties, Ryan.
Oh, yes, girl.
Your wisdom.
If only they knew. If only they knew.
I'll just go back to the archive and let's go there. You'll discover a lot. Okay, let's get into some What's Trending This Hour, though. Fox News refused to air a TV ad blasting President Donald Trump's response to the COVID-19 pandemic during the Republican National Convention, telling the labor union funding it that it was inaccurate. Now, it's a 30-second spot from the American Federation of Teachers Super PAC.
AFT solidarity. It slams Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell for what the union says is failure to provide adequate PPE to educators and a plan for a safe return to public schools during the outbreak. Here's a clip.
I am very worried.
Schools becoming super spreader events.
900 students and staff are in quarantine.
While schools are struggling to reopen, where are Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell? They have no plan.
It is what it is.
Students and teachers forced to put their health and safety at risk.
Teachers are cramming for ways to get PPE.
Our kids are being used as guinea pigs, and it's enraging.
Enough is enough. This November, say no to Trump and McConnell's chaos. AFT Solidarity is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Now, Fox News advertising staff simply told the union the network's legal department would like to see a more specific argument for why it was Trump and McConnell's responsibility.
What? That's not a specific argument saying that we need PPE, we need to have safety in our schools. I mean, I'm not shocked that they turned this down. There's just no way that they would allow any type of like stain to be used against them on their night, right? And I think one thing that we did see on the RNC is like Melania or the Trump administration general kind of using their weaknesses for their strengths. And so there's just no way. There's no way that they would have allowed this to play. I'm not shocked, to be honest.
Well, yeah, they said, Fox News told Huffington Post that they had told the union's representatives that they would air the ad if they corrected what it considered a questionable claim.
Oh my God.
Okay. Now, more than 70 COVID-19 cases have now been linked to an event that drew thousands of tourists to a small South Dakota city earlier this month. And this is from a CNN survey of state health departments. The annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. I didn't know about this until producer Chance, drew it to our attention. It's a 10-day event that usually brings about 500,000 people to the city. And this year, the rally attracted attendees on more than 460,000 vehicles. Experts feared that the rally, which drew people from all over the U.S., including coronavirus hotspots, had the potential to become a spreading event.
This is
not just in the state, but across the country.
This is not shocking that producer Chance knows what a motorcycle rally is. I've never in my life. Who knew they even did stuff like that? What, they just ride in circles?
No. Well, I don't know. Producer Chance, what do they do at these? It's a rally. So they like all appear on their bikes, showing off their bikes.
Oh, that sounds disgusting and heterosexual. Races. And drink.
Yeah, I was right. Producer Chance is nodding his head.
I mean, the heterosexual sexual activity really jumped out with that
one. I'm sure there are people from other types of backgrounds.
I mean, maybe the leather community. Yes, exactly. That's hot.
Now, let's continue. After weeks of encouraging people to get tested if they think they have been exposed to COVID-19, the CDC abruptly changed course and said testing might not be necessary. New York Times is reporting that the CDC was instructed by higher ups within the Trump administration to modify its coronavirus testing guidelines this week to exclude people who do not have symptoms of COVID-19, even if they have been recently exposed to the virus. So yeah, we're going to get into that this week and talk about if that will impact health insurance companies and them paying for us to get tested if we don't have any symptoms, because there's something here that's going on. Now, finally, Africa is free of polio after years of trying to eradicate the virus. That's according to the World Health Organization. Big news here. And it's a landmark achievement. It comes after decades of campaigning and vaccination programs across the continent. No cases of polio have been diagnosed in Africa in 4 years, and that's what is needed to certify eradication of the virus. The last case was detected in 2016 in Nigeria. Now let's move on to top stories in pop culture and entertainment news. What's the tea?
Yes, I got your tea report, those pop culture moments that are trending right now. And let's give a little update on the Kanye West campaign, which honestly, I don't take it seriously. So I'm sorry that I'm probably traumatizing you with this news. Well, it appears that obviously he is going the independent presidential route. He is the independent presidential candidate. He has managed to get on the 2020 presidential ballot in three more states, Idaho, Minnesota, and unfortunately, my home state, Tennessee. Now, look, the Secretary of State's offices in Idaho and Minnesota confirmed on Tuesday that West had officially qualified to be on the 2020 ballot. West filed his petition to be on the ballot in Tennessee last Thursday, just before the state's noon deadline. A spokeswoman for the Tennessee Secretary of State's office said at the time that officials were reviewing West's filings to see if he met the 275 signature requirement. Oh, all he had to do was get 275 signatures?
Wow, we could run for president.
Come on, let's do it.
I have an issue with this because it's like at this point he knows he's not realistically going to win against Joe Biden. So you're doing this just for your own, to prove something to yourself, right?
Well, he's quoted saying giving up's way harder than trying. So that is
So this is just like his own personal growth exercise. Like, what's going on?
No, for sure. And that is your pop culture moment that is trending right now, right here in the Tea Report.
Okay. And again, Feed Our Families is still happening. We're going to keep on reminding you about this because it's so important, because we really want to help children and their families all over Southern California going to bed hungry. Radio.com is an easy way that you can help. Text NEED to 76278. NEED to 76278. Even $1 can help so much right now. And coming up, we discuss what to do if you're feeling jealous of your friend's success. That's next in 10 minutes. Are you unable to feel happy for your friend's success? Do you feel like that makes you a terrible person? Well, joining us is clinical psychologist Dr. Josh Klapo to break this down.
Why do you feel so happy about it?
What do you mean?
You sound so happy about people who might be jealous of their friends. Awful.
I know. I'm just happy in general right now. I don't know. So, welcome back to the show, Dr. Josh. Can you be considered a friend if you can't feel happy for someone that you love and their success?
Yeah, you can be considered a friend. Absolutely. I think more of it's how much you express it and let it take over. So like the whole idea of jealousy and envy, I mean, that's part of being human. So, but I think the difference is you can experience that and kind of have it come and have it go, and then you can be happy for your friend. Where it gets really tough is when it kind of takes over and it forces you to be uncomfortable interacting with your friend and you're kind of faking it. That's when it doesn't make you a bad friend, but that's when you've got a problem.
I don't know. I don't agree. I think it automatically makes you a terrible person and a bad friend, because if you are around like someone, let's just say it's your best friend or whatever, and they are having an amazing amount of success, and you might be kind of internalizing that or projecting your own feelings onto their situation, it just doesn't feel nice to know that there's someone who you thought was in your corner and someone who you thought was like, oh, going to be with you like ride or die and having these feelings. It doesn't feel nice to know that. And especially if they're being weird about it. Like, well,
but you know what? But here's the thing, man, I hope I don't like bust your bubble, dude. Because here's the thing. You absolutely can still be in their corner. I mean, I agree with you. You can be in their corner, can be there with them, for them, and still be conflicted because you're having these views. And so the problem, though, is, Ryan, to your point, here's the problem. If a person having the success and your friend looks and acts like they're generally supportive of you, they may be faking it a little bit. That's the problem. And I'm not saying that they're not your friend, but envy is really powerful. And I was just saying that when it gets to the extreme and they have a hard time interacting with you, yeah, that's when they go from being a deep friend to not a deep friend. But a lot of it is because we're designed to do social comparison. I mean, part of the way we judge the way we are in the world is by looking at other people. So, and that includes our friends.
You see, all right, my take on it is it's a balance. I think that as long as you're honest and transparent and then you take responsibility for it, then I have grace and compassion for you. Because I know, like, we all go through our times where we're feeling like crap about ourselves and insecure. I've been there, so I get it. But if it starts being a consistent thing that then is impacting you and like they're putting it on you so that you can't enjoy it without taking responsibility, that's where it becomes an issue.
Absolutely. It's also your job as the friend or the person who's feeling envious to not spew your envy and your issues on your friend. So like taking ownership and being transparent doesn't necessarily mean telling your friend over and over, I'm so jealous, I'm so envious, my life is not as good as yours, because then now you're just ruining their parade, even with your transparency.
Yeah, have one conversation maybe to like kind of clear things. But then after that, I feel like you need to take responsibility for your feelings. And then, you know, as a friend, if you're having that, you also have to have compassion for that person. But then if your friendship just becomes based on that, then I feel like that is problematic.
Oh, for sure.
you know, it is. And here's the thing, and if I can try to reframe it a little bit. So a lot of times we can be envious and jealous about certain parts of our friend's life, right? I'm jealous about maybe the money they're making or their career. It's super important to check yourself so that you don't let it get global. And you go, I'm jealous about everything, or I'm envious about everything, or I'm not happy for everything. Because a lot of times we have a hard time with certain parts of their success, but there are other parts that we wouldn't trade, and we think we're doing better. So it doesn't have to be all or none. And that also helps keep you grounded and doesn't put you in this position where you go, oh, I'm jealous of everything. I'm envious. I can't be happy about anything they can do.
So what can people do just as we wrap up this topic, like tips, if you find yourself in this situation, what can you do?
Well, give it a little bit of time. So you may initially not be happy for their success because you're processing it. So give it a week, you know, and try to work through it and have that compassion. B, if it's really eating at you, it's okay to say something to them. But say it out of compassion. Look, I'm having a hard time with this. Own it. Like you said, this is my thing. And then I'm going to do the work. And then the last thing is really remind yourself, who is this person that's my friend? Is it them? Or is it all of the things that they have and they do? Why am I a friend with them? And if you remind yourself of that, what you'll realize is you're a friend because they're a person, not because they have successes or not. That's going to help keep you grounded.
All right. Well, Claypo, you're sticking around with us because coming up next, we're going to find out if it's actually healthy to keep following X on social media. We're diving into all the relationship things today. That's in 10 minutes. Is following your ex on social media healthy for you? Are the constant reminders of what you used to have actually bad for you? Well, back with us is clinical psychologist, Dr. Josh Claypo. Thanks again for being with us today.
Sure. Happy to be here.
So I feel like this is happening a lot to people right now as we are stuck inside on social media more than ever. We go back, right? A lot of nostalgia happening, people reappearing from our past. But is there a plain black and white answer to this question? Is following your ex on social media actually bad for you or unhealthy?
Yes, it's unhealthy.
At what point? Well, why?
Wait,
though?
Like, you're saying following your ex is unhealthy?
Yeah.
It's dangerous. When I say dangerous, it can put you in a very difficult emotional place. And Ryan, you make a good point. There's a difference between, like, when I mean following, it's not stalking, but being, you know, friends or following them on social media in that way. Here's the problem. You know, if you got kids, if you're connected in some other way, it's a different story, right? That's a different story.
Right.
But if you have no reason to be connected to them and that relationship has broken up, then you really have no reason to stay connected with them on social media. And here's why it's problematic. It doesn't allow, and I don't care if you're the one who broke up or you're the one who got broke up with, it doesn't allow you to fully move forward psychologically, emotionally, because you're constantly got one foot back in the past. Shira brought up the nostalgia part. You know, the nostalgia part is different. Maybe if you go back after somebody after 5-10 years, that's a whole nother discussion. Okay. But if you've just broken up, it is, and you can even say something, because it can be an amicable breakup. You can even say to the person, look, I'm going to unfollow you, or I'm not going to follow you. It's not because I hate you, but I need to get on with my life. Because if you don't, you are just, you're basically torturing yourself psychologically before you move forward. That's all. And that's why I said it's dangerous.
Well, this is so interesting, because I feel like this is a very controversial take. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I'm not a fan of following my exes. When I first broke up with my ex, even though it was kind of a messy breakup, I blocked them. And we just started kind of being back in communication over these last couple of years. But what's interesting is, why is there such a stigma? Because I think some people argue, well, if you are mature enough, if you have moved on completely, you should be able to see that person, see your ex on social media, and it just be a cool thing. And so that's why people say your take and the take that I agree with is controversial.
Because if you just broke up, and it, you know, the time is a little bit arbitrary, but let's say within 6 months to a year, you haven't just moved on. You think you've just moved on, but you haven't just moved on. you haven't moved on fully psychologically. I treat this as like a death. I really do. I call it a social death. It is, you got to have enough time to move forward. And Ryan, I think is interesting. If you've moved forward with your life, and this is where we agree with this. If you move forward, why are you still connected? What is the reason to be connected?
I agree.
I feel like Ryan's about to probably drag me.
No, I agree because Shira is that girl, and I don't understand. She loves to be friends with her ex, and I'm like, well, that is so unhealthy. Well,
just a recent one. Okay, to be clear, my other exes, like, because I'm older, social media wasn't around, so we didn't have to go through that. It was much easier to end things and not see each other and connect. And of course, maybe through work or things that would come up years later, but we'd all be in other relationships. It was fine and healthy. The recent one has been the hardest because, but he's not as much on social media, but we're still connected over text. And he hasn't met someone. And he said to me recently, and this is that he missed me and he might want to come back to LA. And I'm falling for someone. And like, imagine how conflicted I feel that I'm still in touch with him in that way because we're both single still, right?
Yeah, that's a whole show. But yeah.
It normally is, Dr. Josh.
But you're exactly
right. It's a love line.
But that is, and you know, I'm a little older too. And so, yes, before social media, when you were broke up, there really was no way to reconnect. Now, and that's why I'm saying you're kind of torturing yourself. It doesn't mean you have to hate them. It doesn't mean that you're not going to necessarily be friends. It just means you're giving yourself enough space, each of you enough space to truly move forward with your life. Then, like Ryan said, maybe after a year, come back and reconnect.
Dr. Josh Klepo is with us right now as we talk about following your ex on social media. I do think, and I wonder if codependency plays into it, and it's something to look at on both sides, but you both need to be aware enough of that to see that and how that's playing into the consistent communication or connection on social media.
Well, again, absolutely. If you've broken up, you don't need to be communicating on a daily basis or on a regular basis. Again, go back to the, why did you break up? If you broke up, you don't need to be that kind of connected. And I'm not saying dump that person out of your life. What I'm saying is allow your brain to process the loss, to truly move forward. And then maybe you circle back like the example Ryan gave in the beginning. But if you start right off the bat, you are just putting yourself emotionally in a much more difficult position than you need to be.
So where's the line between being bitter and just moving on? Because I think oftentimes people can wrap that up and say, well, aren't you just holding grudges and being bitter?
Or guilt.
Like if you're like, the reason why I'm saying bitter is because like, if you're saying, well, I don't want to follow them on social media, I don't want to see them. Yeah. That could come off as bitter, or you have a grudge towards them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you really are adult and mature about it, Ryan, great example. You let that person know. You literally say, look, this is really hard for me. I'm not bitter. I don't hate you, but I need to not be in contact so that I can move on. And you can do it in a way that is compassionate.
Ah, my heartstrings. Okay, Dr. Josh Klepo, we appreciate you being here again for all these conversations.
Thanks, guys.
Now coming up, the HBO Max show celebrating queer history is here. That's next in our Yaz Queen of the Day. Before we get into our Yaz Queen of the Day, a reminder about Feed Our Families, an initiative we're doing here at radio.com, because children and their families all over Southern California are going to bed hungry. Yes. And you can donate and be part of that change. Just text the word need to 76278, need to 76278. And for more info, go to wearechannelq.com. We've got time. We've been raising a lot of money. We're going to make a big difference together.
Get involved, everyone. Do what you got to do.
Yep. All right. Let's get into our Yaz Queen of the Day.
Yes, Queen.
Where we feature a lot of people doing what they got to do to make a difference. Now, let's give this one to 14-year-old baker in Tennessee, William Cabanis, who was making his own food when he had an idea. He could raise funds for his local food bank, Second Harvest Food Bank of East Tennessee, by making and selling every baker's best friend vanilla extract. Because I don't bake that much. I didn't know.
I didn't know that either. I was like, okay, I was thinking of some cupcakes, some red velvet cake, some honey buns, some cinnamon buns. I was thinking all that. That's a baker's best friend. But vanilla extract, I guess, did I say extract?
This is the ingredients.
Yeah, I think I said ashtray. I literally think I said vanilla ashtray.
You know what?
Sounds like it would taste good, right? Or maybe not. So this is the ingredients that everyone needs. And here they are on the local news talking about everything that they've done and the difference they've made.
I think a lot of the time spent was finding the right bottle, figuring out labeling, building his website.
Making some vanilla extract, and then I trying to get social media, a website, get some stuff ready to launch. It was a long process, but I think it paid off.
So, as you heard, since then, William has made over $9,000 in profits, providing over 27,000 meals for those in need.
Amazing.
A future philanthropist.
Philanthropist? A future philanthropist. No, we're keeping that. It's okay. I said vanilla ash.
It's Wednesday. Okay, it's Wednesday. We're not at Friday yet. But I love this. And these little kids are like entrepreneurs. They're going to be like the future, you know, startup founders.
You know, I wish I was doing stuff like that when I was younger, like trying to either be a baker or whatever. I just don't know why I wasn't doing that or creating a hobby. Because look at this. This hobby is creating a whole thing at this point. And he's doing such a good job.
Yeah, what are we doing, Ryan? I always say this after Yas Queen. What are we doing?
That's really what this segment's about. We say it's about highlighting amazing people, but really it's just there to humble us and make us feel terrible about our
lives. Hashtag, what are you doing today? Now, HBO Max has unveiled the full cast for Equal. It's an upcoming four-part docuseries chronicling landmark events and the heroes of the LGBTQ+ movement that we've forgotten. And Samira Wiley, Cheyenne Jackson, Anthony Rapp, Sarah Gilbert. I mean, talk about a cast.
Don't forget our very own Jay Rodriguez. Well, yeah. He used to be on Channel Q. He's a dear friend of our show, all that good stuff. Queer Eye, he's amazing. He's on that show as well.
They're going to all portray the LGBTQ+ visionaries in the docuseries that contains never-before-seen archival footage. And you can check that out very soon on HBO Max. And that's our Yas Queen of the day.
Yes, Queen.
Now, coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to be looking at what a second Trump term could mean for LGBTQ+ people in the community.
Oh, God. It sounds like it means like depression and people wanting to escape. That's what it means to me.
Well, we're going to look at all the angles and all the sides right here on Let's Go There, that and more tomorrow, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern, right here on Channel Q. And guess what? We post all these shows and interviews as a podcast. Join our podcast family. Just go to the radio.com app, search Let's Go There, and subscribe so you're notified when we post new episodes. It means a lot to us because, you know, that's how we continue doing what we do. We are sending you love and light.
Thank God. Oh, all right, y'all. Remember to slay.
See you tomorrow. Have a great night.
Bye.